Welcome to this, the One White Woman podcast. Today, I welcome, with greatest respect and appreciation, Dr. Rochelle Rogers Ard. Rochelle is a published author, adjunct professor, district administrator, and she has over 25 years' experience as an organizational development specialist focused on coaching school and business leaders in effective approaches for dismantling racist policies, racist practices, and racist procedures that threaten organizational health. Currently, Dr. Ard is the principal lead for Harvest Consulting. At the start of our conversation, Rochelle shares her observation that we are all leaders in whatever our realms of interactions may be. She then goes on to identify main characteristics of leaders that we naturally want to follow or emulate, compared to those that do not inspire us to follow or emulate them. Real relationships, Rochelle pointed out, are based on the people in those relationships being seen, and being seen is a prerequisite for the possibility to engage in courageous conversations. In this conversation, which I am so grateful to be able to share with all other white people who are sincere in their efforts to heal the destructive racial divisions in this country, Rochelle describes, with uncommon clarity, the mindset required for us to make forward progress together. One particularly helpful insight I gained from Rochelle for checking my whiteness in relation to Black people is to be aware of my surprise, spoken, thought, or wordlessly felt in response to Black people's intelligence, accomplishments, skills, talents, etc., etc. Have you ever noticed that response in yourself, even if you didn't give voice to it? That is clear evidence of how we, as white people, have been programmed as superior, and to expect inferior intelligence, accomplishments, and skills from Black people. This is the insidious nature, to use Rochelle's vocabulary, of how white privilege and white supremacy manifest, most often under the radar of our own conscious awareness. It hurts a lot more than I can say to tell you how I've caught those thoughts, to tell you that I've caught those thoughts, which I really hate to admit, even to myself. But if I don't catch them, and if I don't admit to myself that I caught them, then how else can I become more conscious of and eventually eliminate the programming that I and all of us whites grew up with? Rochelle tells us that we need to name what is invisible to make it visible, because as Ibram X. Kendi explains, the heartbeat of racism is denial. That's worth repeating. The heartbeat of racism is denial. I am your host, Nene White, and I hope you're here because you're open to learning how to phase out that heartbeat of denial and replace it with true understanding and the conscious will to move our collective mindset forward for everyone's benefit. Thank you for being here. Thank you. And just a quick few words about how much I value Rochelle, her insights, and her communication skills that have made a real difference for me. Rochelle Rogers Ard explains things that I have been trying to understand for quite some time now in ways that really sink in for me and help me to shift to another level of understanding and therefore more constructive interactions with Black people, because she's given me that insight and given it to me in a way that I feel it and understand it. Feel it in my heart, understand it in my mind. So I am so very grateful for this conversation with her. She is one in a million, and I know when you listen to her, you will appreciate that as well.
Rochelle.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hey. Hi.
Thank you for being here with all my heart. I am so excited about this conversation, about the honor of talking with you and learning from you. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
When I look at your information about you on the web, I see that you've accomplished so much. You have thoughts and impressions and influence in so many areas. So I'm going to just have to pick up one, and maybe I'm sure we'll talk into some others, and you'll help me decide what the priorities are in this conversation.
Cool.
Good, good. But I loved a quote that I saw from you, that great leaders focus on real relationships, courageous connections, and outstanding outcomes. And so I want to see what your definition of real relationships is, and then courageous connections, and how you evoke that, how you help that to happen for people.
Sounds good. Thank you. And I love it when people do their research. So thanks so much for that.
Of course.
You know, I think in this time, specifically when I wrote that, my gosh, I think it might have been 2 years ago, maybe three, but it was definitely pre-pandemic. And I was writing from a place of, I believe that all of us are leaders, and I believe we all move in a way that provides leadership for others, specifically if we're in the field of education, but certainly just in the way that we move, many of us are leaders in our homes or leaders in community or what have you. And so when I was thinking about a leader that I wanted to follow, because you know, there's leaders and then there's leaders we want to follow, right? So when I was thinking about that, there were the leaders that I felt like I felt like I had a relationship with them. Like there was something that was extremely tangible that I felt like I could get from them. And then they didn't shy away from the hard conversations, but they had tools to be able to have those conversations in a way that I didn't feel like it was threatening or shaming or blaming. And then as a result of all of that, they did really important work. And so then they had these great outcomes with their work, right? And so that was then, right? Then we had the pandemic.
Right.
And it became even more critical that we focus on real relationships, right? People were isolated. And the pandemic was the first time I think you know how you know something, but then you feel something. I knew that there were differences in the medical and educational system. We all knew that. But being able to see it in real time. And
when you say differences in the medical.
Inequities between those who have and have not, specifically around medical care, benefits, access to healthy foods, all of the disparities that I've been in education my whole life. So we've all, there's disparities, but there's something about when a school district has to provide food during a pandemic that families get to go and pick up, that makes it real.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's tangible.
Yeah.
And I was so amazed at the number of families for whom this food was the food they were receiving, right? So as schools were able to, particularly here in Oakland Unified, schools were able to have large amounts of food giveaways, and the families who were like, thank you, because we would not be eating, right? Were it not for this food. Man, I knew it, but uh-huh. I didn't get a chance to feel it and to see it in yeah. that way.
Yeah.
So the leaders who focus on real relationships, for me, we all have those surface relationships, right? But the ones who actually really see the folks that they're leading and see as in the sum of their human experience, right? Like the movie Avatar, where they were like, I see you, like really being able to see who people are. Those are the ones who are able to forge real relationships. And then when you have those relationships, you can have the courage to engage in conversations that are a little, could be a little dicey, but based upon that real relationship, you can really get to that, which then leads to better outcomes and deeper outcomes. So for me, I like to say, Nini, every single thing is a relationship. Listen, you can say almost anything, and I will tell you how it's really just like a relationship, because we're all humans, right? And so those of us who, this is a social emotional learning piece, as you know, right? Those of us who are able to really develop quality relationships are usually able to move our leadership in a very, very different way. So that's what that quote meant for me.
I love it. And I love that you put in the necessity to feel what you know, because if you don't feel it, then you only partially know it. And then you don't really own it. And then you get to ownership.
Yes.
And then it just shifts the whole dynamic, as you're saying. So then you can move into those courageous, those areas that require courage, but it's almost like the courage comes with the ownership and the combination of the knowing and the feeling, because you're no longer outside of it.
Right. It has to be, and this is the issue with race work, right? It has to be deeply embedded in the way that I move, like who I am, right? I often say, Brené Brown says we lead based on who we are. And I say we lead based on who we are and our racial context, right? That until you really know yourself around race, it is, you can lead folks across difference, but it's just like you said, there's a difference in knowing and feeling and being able to really intentionally look within to make that connection with that person and to understand all that they bring in their racial context, that requires a different type of knowing.
You're helping me to start to understand and to feel what is required of me as a white person that I've been working on for quite a while now. Start.
Well, it's a journey.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a journey.
Would you mind saying that again? I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's a journey.
No, I mean the part that you said before.
Yeah, there's a difference, right? That difference in knowing and then feeling, right, creates a different type of knowing. So when you are a leader or just a person moving in this world and you're trying to connect with people across who are across difference, gender, race, religion, right? It requires you to figure out something within yourself that can both see, acknowledge, right? And that see, I mean, there's not a better word for it, but really it's a being able to see past surface and see deeply into the humanness that we all share, right? When we can do that, and it can touch something within us like it did for that example that I talked about with the food for many, yes, many people who needed that, then that becomes a different way of knowing. So I now understand differently food insecurity. I now understand differently from a place of having seen and experienced it, but also not from a place of like I'm looking outside myself at these people like, oh my God, I can't believe you're dealing with this, but rather to open myself up to, wow, that could be me had not these three things happened, right? I'm like three steps away from that. Right. So that becomes a different way of knowing that then allows me to connect with people differently, right? And that's what has to happen as we develop more white co-conspirators. I don't use allies anymore because this is you know, war. And so I need folks who are being co-conspirators in the work to help move the work forward.
What I thank you for rephrasing that, because it helps, you know, when you look at it from a different
several different ways.
The other part of it is, though, to for for me as a white woman, because we're having this conversation because you're Black and I'm white, and I'm trying to do whatever needs to be done. And I, you know, and part of it is that I need to know and understand my whiteness, how it impacts this relationship, or what would you say to that?
Yeah, no, the very like, oh, thank you, Nini. That's a clear distinction, right? Because I think there are a lot of very well-meaning, you know, good folks who are white who are like, you know what, I just really want to spend more time talking to Black people about their experience, right? And while that has its place, the very first thing we have to all understand is the place that the role that whiteness plays in this country, right? And so for white folks, really taking the time to see the intentional ways in which systems were set up, not just to privilege folks, because I think a fair amount of white folks are like, okay, I get that there's privileges, right?
Right, right.
But it's more insidious than right. that, right? Yeah. Yeah. There's just a feeling there is a way in which white folks are socialized, particularly in this country, that is a mindset that allows whiteness to continue, right? Like, I'm certainly not the first person to talk about whiteness. Like, folks have been talking about, my gosh, race and everything in this country for years, right? Decades. But there is a mindset that allows whiteness to continue. There's a mindset that simultaneously talks about dismantling while also protecting privilege, right? There is a mindset that for some, we've seen recently with the banning of CRT in certain states, CRT being critical race theory in certain right. states, there is, you know, there is this notion of, yes, we want to have rights for everyone, but we're going to also simultaneously deny that these pieces exist and right. thereby protect, right?
Right. right?
What is that that allows white folks to, Robin DiAngelo would say, this is the good, bad binary, that as long as you're not wearing a white hood and, you know, physically harming folks of color, that I'm okay, right?
right?
What is the piece? And this is the work that white folks have to do in affinity, right?
Right.
What is it that allows the simultaneous words of, yes, we definitely want to have this shift while we're also protecting privilege and allowing whiteness to continue? And I don't know the answer. There are those who have said there's a lot of theories around what that is, but what we know is that it continues. What we know that is that it's 2021, right? This is not the first time. There's about a million books, right? About yeah. race, about white supremacy, right? Like, it's not the first time. So the question is, what is it that allows whiteness to continue? And I believe, that it is the manner in which we are socialized in this country that allows it to continue. So when you look at children in elementary school, white children, Black children, well, let me just tell a quick, so my daughter, you know, we're in Oakland, so Oakland should be progressive, right? Let's liberal-esque, right? So because I'm in education, I purposefully send her to not the neighborhood school, but to the school 15, 20 minutes away, under this notion that this is going to get a better education because this was a predominantly white school, right? So I work the system and get her into this school. Second grade, she meets this lovely little boy, let's call him David. And she's in class with David, second grade, third grade, and somewhere around fourth grade. It's Valentine's Day. And he wants to give my daughter, who is African-American, he wants to give her a flower. We don't know what the conversation was, but he told his mom, I've gotta deliver this Valentine's Day gift. And he goes to the, you know, we have the addresses and the little directory, what have you, and he's, you know, he's there. And the mom didn't know Doriel was African-American, right? And this little boy, David, is white. And so there was this horror that could not be masked, right? When she goes back, and so she takes this little tiny little flower and a little, you know, the cute little vase. I mean, it's harmless, right? It's fourth grade. It's, you know, nobody's getting married here. Okay. Yeah. So she goes back to school and he's like, I can't like you like that because you're Black. And so it is, you know, this is a, not a mom who's out, you know, right. In the picture that we have of white supremacy, right?
Right, right, right.
But there is a way that we socialize our children who grow up around this notion of being better than others, right? And so I believe it's the socialization of how we raise white children in this country, which critical race theorists would talk about the way that this is whiteness as property, because it's actually passed down generation to generation. Black people, from my own knowledge and other folks of color, grow up not thinking we're better than, thinking we have to be as good as. Ugh. Right? That's what the whole, when we talk about the racial wealth gap, or when we talk about the gaps in education, test scores and all those other things, the standard is whiteness. We look at the, what are white children, how are they faring on standardized tests? And we use that as the standard. And then we look at Black and other white children of color, and then we ascertain there's a gap because that's the standard. So we grow up thinking, man, you better get to that standard. Like, so either you need to be able to work at that level or test at that level or go to those colleges, right? Because that's the standard of excellence. So the question then becomes for white folks, how do we shift that mindset?
Yeah.
So that the future generations are not being raised to value their whiteness as property.
Okay. So, when you talk, I have about, oh my God, I got to ask her this.
I know. It's because it's a lie. I get it.
Of course it's a lie. I want to ask what you said to your daughter.
Oh, okay.
And then I want to ask, did you follow through in any other way with the school? Nothing to say.
So, you know, I think, the conversation with my daughter was where the work happens, right? It was not the school's fault. Certainly, you know, certainly the mother has a right to say what she wants to say to her child.
I didn't mean it that way. I just meant, I don't know, is there any way that we can bring more awareness and knowledge into
it? I didn't want Doriel's experience to be...
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
an example.
And she was like, what? And she came home and was like, Mom, what? Yeah. What I had to say to her, though, is, you know, first of all, not all white folks are like that. So this is the experience that you had at fourth grade. But also understand that some are like that.
Yeah.
This is where we, you know, where we see some real serious beginnings of the types of activities that we've seen over the last few years, particularly with George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, when that is part of the way in which you are raised, right? And so I had to have, there was a series of commercials a while ago that were entitled The Talk. Yeah. And I don't know if it's Johnson & I couldn't remember what the brand was, but they sort of shone a light on the conversations that we as Black parents have to have with our children that white parents don't have to have with theirs, right?
Right.
And I have three boys and a girl, or three grown folks, but anyway, males is my point. The conversation I had to have with the males, very, very different from the conversation I had to have with the female, but either way, conversation had to happen.
Yeah.
right? And so what does it mean for me to send you out into this world that is an anti-Black world where you could be stopped by the police or anyone else and asked why you were physically there?
Yeah.
Right. So what we saw with all the Karens in the last couple of years was you don't deserve to be here. And I need to ask you why you're here, because every place is a white place. But that happens very frequently with men. With women, it's more like I'm surprised that you're here. Or what I often get is how well I speak. And I know people are like, do people still say that? And I am telling you that 2 or 3 months ago, a very well-meaning white colleague was like, oh my God, Rochelle, you speak so well. And I was like, thank you. Let's look at why you felt like you needed to say that. There's a difference between saying, yo, content is dope. What I've heard you, Nene, say is like, every time you talk, I get big ideas. Like that's content, right? But this person was like, I just think you speak so well. And I was like, as opposed to whom? And like just have a mindset awareness of what that means when you say that. And she was totally apologetic, right? But it's the surprise that, right? Yeah. So those conversations were big, and no need to go to, you know, to blow this into, here's the example of what happened.
No,
because that parent's going to have to figure that out.
But that's sure. But this is what you do.
Oh, right.
Okay.
But so I didn't I'm do just, it then when she was.
You're not getting on your horses, huh?
Yeah. No. When she was in fourth grade, I was still teaching. I think I was running a program in the district. So that was not what I would do at that point. Yeah.
All right. Not even in a, but just, you know, oh, this is an opportunity because it's so close to home. And because, so you said no, so I'm going to let that one go.
Well, I'm going to say that because there's a million opportunities.
Of course.
Like this was just a story of one. So I would spend my entire time, I wouldn't be able to do any work if I talked to all of the African-American parents and was like, share a story, like we would just be doing that. So I think the piece is it's not isolated.
No, of course not. Of course.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about your work and about the impact of your work to for us to get a sense of progress, because I like to understand problems, and then I need to see where the progress and the forward motion is happening so that we can all feel encouraged, you know, to not move off to an island and just give up, you know.
Island is sounding really good right about now, Nene, I gotta tell you. I'm not going to say a popular opinion. So this is gonna be unpopular.
Good.
Okay.
This is the courage part, right?
Yeah, this is real. I don't see an improvement in racism in this country in my time. I don't see it in my daughter's time. I feel like what I am doing, my work is laying the seeds and the groundwork and the foundation for what my unborn grandchildren and their children may have an opportunity to experience a different world for them. And the reason I say that is because I believe the hope is through the next two generations. I believe that young people, my daughter's gonna be 22 next month. So her generation, the folks she's raising, and then those grandchildren will experience something differently. And it's unpopular because people are like, wait a minute, aren't we making progress? And so here's how I look at that. No, we're not making progress. We're making some steps that are little tiny little seeds, you know, like when you, do you garden? Okay, so a little like, you know, it takes time for those seeds to take root and to like, and you got it, you know, there's pruning and all these things that have to happen. We have had 400 plus years of racism and oppression in this country. It's not going to be reversed because Joe Biden signs, you know, a law, right? So, you know, and You know, more on that later, but just like, I appreciate, I was like, this is great, Joe. Thanks so much. Probably what we need more than a holiday is definitely like, let's reverse the ability for everyone to learn about critical race theory. Like, you know, let's get some concretes, but you know, little tiny baby steps for our administration. But the reason that I say that, I'm gonna use something that's not based in race. The way that we talk about mental health today is beautiful. It is so encouraging. And I can go back and look at the way that people in my community, at least, used to talk about, it was old timers disease. It was, when people would do things, he's just crazy. No, there's mental health issues there, right? Over time.
That are addressable.
That now that we know that are addressable, but for which we did not have language.
Right.
When I was growing up, they just said people were crazy. Like no one said, I never heard, you need to work on your anxiety. I never heard that growing up. What I heard was, oh, you're feeling anxious? You better get over it, right? You know, so right. I see a huge shift in the way we are bringing mental health to the forefront and allowing people to talk about self-care and talk about doing things differently.
Yeah,
that is over time, because of course there's privilege with that, right? So people who can take self-care and do the things and go to yoga classes and sit on it, you know, they're often have an ability to be able to afford that, right? Right. So for right. your folks who are furthest from opportunity, they're like, you want me to take off work to go to, right? Because I don't get paid. Okay. So I see that as by the time Doriel has children, it's going to be a way of life, right? That this notion of self-care, we may go to 4-day work weeks. I mean, there will be flex, right? This is the shift that started in the 70s talking about mental health, right? Yeah. Yeah. Where people yeah. were like, I think there's this thing called mental. I remember when yoga first came out. And yeah. people were like, yoga?
Yeah. Meditation.
Right. What's that? That's those, you know, those people in Berkeley. Like, that's yeah. for those, right? Yeah. So over that many generations and decades, we are now having these conversations. So if you think about that as sort of a ruler of what it takes in time, and then you put that next to oppression and racism, it's going to take even more time to stem the tide. And so when I tell people this, they are often like, well, I'm moving to that island because I, you know, we yeah. need to get it together now. And all I can yeah. say is we're laying the groundwork. We're not going to see it, but we're right. laying the groundwork.
But in your work, I mean, this is what you're dedicated to. Yes. What kind of progress are you seeing? What kind of progress are you, how much can you get through to people when you speak in the school districts or in the corporations? I mean, can you give
I'm
us
not
some...
really sure. It is work without tangible outcomes.
Because people are so
mired. Yes. And so I'll get someone to say, like, I have a school with whom I'm working that was like, wow, Rochelle, you are really shifting the way we talk about this work. And I was like, beautiful. That's a concrete outcome. And, you know, they are now naming what was invisible and making it visible. And that is great. I will never know if people are actually becoming anti-racist or if they're using the nomenclature so that they can feel like they're part of the work. I won't know that, and we won't know that for a while to come. I mean, I think our children at that school may be able to feel something differently. And that's one school after 2 years. So I'm okay with, you know, I'm an educator. So I, you know, this is just like asking a teacher, do you know if your children are really successful? And the question right. is, you don't know till your children get grown. They come back and go, do you know, as a result of what you did, I am just, and you're like, great, right? So I'm used to working without seeing yeah. the outcome.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. I love how you answer things. Yeah. I think one of my favorite things about talking to you is your honesty and your realness, you know, yeah. because then we've got firm footing to ask the next question and to yeah. think, about the next layer of thoughts and understanding to go forward. And I really appreciate that with you and respect it with you. And
Amy, I appreciate you giving me that feedback, because I do feel like there are some folks who do this work who are in the shame blame place. Yeah. And I'm not in that place, right? I can't, number one, I'm a teacher, like in my heart, in my core, right? So I'm never going to go to a student and they don't get my lesson and go, well, you're just, you know, not trying hard enough to get, like, that's not how we teach. So that's the first thing that goes against my principles. But this work is just friggin' difficult. And so to receive feedback that people are able to have the on-ramps into it is helpful, because I don't think we're gonna, that change that I'm talking about for my great grandchildren is not gonna happen if we don't, you know, if we're not able to have conversations, those really courageous conversations. So I appreciate that feedback.
Oh, so when you say courageous, that implies calling on something inside that is wants to not, but it does.
Yeah.
Can you define that more? Because I've heard that term before, and I want to understand how you understand it, how you see it when it happens.
Anti-racist work is work of courage, right? In this country, Kendi says that the heartbeat of racism is its denial. And so the notion that when we say there's like, oh, it's not racist, or I'm not racist, or things aren't racist, then we allow racism to continue. So when I say make the invisible visible, it requires courage to go, you know, when you said that was like a microaggression rooted in racism, right? Or it requires courage to say, you know what, today we're going to sort of have a round table and share some of the stories of overlooked folks of color in this organization. And we're gonna have to hear some harsh realities that may not be meaningful, may not, you know, that folks don't wanna hear.
And what happens in those meetings?
So, you know, I got a story. So I-
I do.
Yeah. At my, one of my previous places of employment, an African-American woman who was part of the clerical team sent an email and to the team or what have you. And a white male who was not her supervisor came up to her and was like, yeah, you spelled this word wrong and I need you to know about that. And so I saw her and she was visibly upset and I didn't know what had happened. But I was like, hey, you know, what's going on, sis? What's happening? And she was like, I can't believe this dude is calling me out about this. I'm trying to, you know, I'm working as hard as I can, blah, 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 blah. But he had no right. And, you know, he was very, you know, rude with it. And I was like, well, can we tell, you know, your supervisor or his supervisor? And she was like, I don't want to rock the boat, right? I want to do my job. I want to go home. But this was really hard for me. Because of my positionality, I then told someone who was on senior level cabinet, right? And that person said, you know, that might be an isolated incident, but, you know, we're doing really good work here and we don't want, like, you know, blowing the lid off, in other words, of something like this could sort of turn the tide on some of the work that we're doing. And we don't really want to deal with that. And so the unspoken piece here is we feel really good about the work we've been doing around equity. We don't want to hear that there's some incidents that are happening, because that could make people think that we're not doing the work that we think that we're doing. And I've already told myself that I feel good about this. And so we don't want to bring that up. And so you have to have courage to say, no, we do want to hear that, right? Because these are the isolated incidents that can both build and destroy culture. But we also have to have the courage to look at go, wow, we thought we were doing a lot better, but obviously we have some more work to do in this area. Similarly, we have to have the courage to have those of us who, like myself, are like, no, I'm ready to have the conversation and to support those people, as opposed to what normally happens or what's happened in my experience, which is sort of a silencing of anyone who feels like they already are ready to have those conversations, because we don't want to hear it. We don't want to uncover our dirty laundry. And this is indicative of not just that organization, but us as a country. We don't want to hear it, which is why we are, you know, saying that in certain states, we can't have critical race theory taught. We don't want to uncover our dirty laundry. We don't want to show that, because it's fear, right? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says there's only two emotions, love and fear. You're either living in love or you're living in fear. Fear is what stops us from being courageous. What will happen if we start educating people about the way this country was actually founded? What will happen if white folks have to really take time and go, hi, I'm a white person and I have privilege and I'm trying to learn how to dismantle white supremacy? What will happen, right? Like, there's fear around that. And that's why there has to be courage.
Okay, now I have to ask this. If someone came up to me, I want to understand this incident.
Yep.
And why it's a microaggression.
Yep.
Because there must be, this micro element is part of it, clearly. Because if someone came up to me and said that, even if he was a jerk, I wouldn't, even if he was black and I was white, or whatever, a man, you know, I wouldn't take it that way.
Right.
So I'm trying to understand you, because, you know, we whites don't understand a lot of time. I don't feel it. I hear you.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So help me understand.
So the first
this.
Thing is, I have a fair amount of white colleagues who will be like, girl, you need to go and do this, right? And I'm like, slow down. You can do that from a place of privilege that I cannot, right? So restaurants and talking to different people in public spaces where there is a privilege associated with being white that allows white folks to feel like, oh, I'm gonna say something in this way, or I'm not gonna take it this way, because they don't see this as part of them making a mistake. They just see that there was a mistake made, and what's the big deal, right? However, particularly for Black women, and I'm using women specifically, there were two pieces here. There was a gender piece and there was a race piece. This was a white male talking to a Black female who's in a lower socioeconomic position, and that in other words, the email wasn't even to him, right? I mean, like, he was on it, but this, you know, he was not a team member. This is someone to whom she did not report.
Okay.
So, right? This is someone who took it upon his own.
Okay.
Right?
I'm sorry, get it.
To go to this woman and be like, you need to work on your, you know, the way that you spell or whatever, you know. And when I hear you say white people don't get it, I agree. Because what folks don't do is stop and go, even, you know, this notion of well-intentioned, but even if this gentleman were feeling like, man, I just need to let her know so that the next time she sends an email.
Right.
You need to figure out the way to say that, so that you don't come off as this ridiculous male overbearing jerk, to
know
use
it
your
all.
Word,
yeah.
With this Black woman who, again, was in a different socioeconomic piece and was also older. And so, like, there's just so many issues there.
Okay.
This is the social emotional piece, right?
Okay.
Let me think before. And I get you, Nini, because had he walked up to me, I would have been like, oh yeah, so I made an error, right? You know, because I move in a place of privilege, acknowledging my own privilege as a doctor, right? That I get to be like, oh yeah, you know.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
I can't believe you caught me on that error, right? You know.
Okay.
Oh, right. But because this woman is in a different place, we've got to be like, man, we all as humans,
yes,
have to
yes.
be able to think, do I need to say this?
Right.
And if I do, in what ways can I say this? How would I want someone to approach me? Right. Right? Which certainly may not have made it better, but can help mitigate some of those isms, right? Those gender pieces. I mean, patriarchy is something.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, right? So there's all these things.
Right.
But we also have to be able to say as an organization, man, this is what we do. This is how we talk to each other. This is how we respect each other across difference. This is a person who didn't know how to approach anyone because he didn't have to. From his place of privilege.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Now, the other side of that is what I find myself doing sometimes. And I got called on it by this marvelous young man, a black man, Adarius, because what I would do with him sometimes when I needed to get clarity or just shift whatever was happening with his cooperation, I would just be all, and he said, Mimi, just tell me what you need. So, I mean, I adore him for, you know, because I was going over in the opposite direction, which was not helpful and almost disrespectful in another kind of a way.
Just a little frustrating. It's like, what's happening?
It's frustrating. Okay, so I mean, but.
Yeah, but that goes back to relationships, right? So when I tell you I have several really good friends, white colleagues, we develop relationship over time so that when something jumps off, they can check me and I can check them from a place of love, where I'm like, oh yeah, did I come off too harsh? She was like, well, you know, I might have, right? And we can have those conversations from that real relationship.
Yep.
Similarly, someone in a good relationship can tell me, girl, you know that whatever you sent, girl, that was not your best work. And then I'll be like, you're right. I was like, I should have read that. Right. But people who don't know me coming up to me as, you know, just the random white person, check your privilege and ask yourself some like really, like it's those internal messages.
Yeah.
You know, do I need to say this? And if so, how might this be, you know, taken differently? So it's a moment of checking. Am I in my privilege of saying this? But really, actually, the first thing is, do I need to say this? Listen,
right.
One time someone asked me, I think it was you, Nini, what would you tell white folks? And, you know, I have so many things I want to say. But the first thing for me, when you think about all those Karens and all those things that happen, the question becomes, do you need to, like, what is it that makes particularly white women feel like they need to speak to particularly people of color about all types of perceived situations? Like, what is it? And so I would ask folks, like, do you really need to be the one to talk about this? This is what we saw when people were calling the police on people jogging and little girls selling cookies and all those, like, what is it that makes you feel like I need,
yeah,
right, I need to tell somebody? So what historians say is that is inbred in the culture of whiteness, particularly for white women, because in the colonial times, white women would tell their male brothers, fathers, what have you, when there was a perceived slight. Right. And that often had very, very violent effects. But that was the way that things happened. So, you know, they were protectors. And white women were like, I've had a slight, or this happened, or did you know this happened, or did you know this happened? And as a result of that, right, then there would be the cavalry coming to the rescue. what we're seeing with a lot of these Karens and a lot of times when white women particularly speak out is a continuation of that behavior.
Oh my God, this rings so true. It just, oh my God.
It's the run, tell that. I've got to run, tell it.
God, but and then we get into the epigenetics, how this kind of stuff is, you know, it's in our genes.
Yes.
I mean, you see so much in the genes, in the passed down, and it's just, but it doesn't have to be. We have free will still, but we have to become conscious.
Yes.
And we have to engage in, or at least listen to the kinds of conversations that you and I are having right now.
Absolutely.
And just allow that there might be a different perspective. Just even allow that.
Right. Absolutely.
Because another question that I have for you, among the trillion that are on the shelf waiting, is like when you go into a corporation or an organization or a school and talk with a group of leaders or faculty or all the different groups that you speak to, there's got to be some that are there because they have to be.
Oh my gosh, yes, absolutely.
And so do you, what can be done in those situations? What kind of tools or what do you?
Yeah, I've done Lean Six Sigma in terms of a change management process in part of my previous life. And so any change management, right? We know the research suggests that you're going to get 25% early adopters. And this is any change management that you're doing in an organization, right? You'll get 25% early adopters. You'll get 50% on the cusp, right? They're going to try and figure some stuff out. And those are the ones that you've got to get to because they're like, well, maybe not. In a school district, these are the cynical teachers who are like, listen, we've seen this all before. What makes you think that we're going to do something now, right? You're going to get 25% of those who are like, yes, this is the new. You're going to get 50% who are like, you know, show me, prove it to me, right? But you're going to get 25% that are never, ever going to adopt. Right. And you just have to know that.
Right.
So I call those the pushback people. And it's totally expected. I mean, I think it's expected. I expect it based upon the work that I've done in change management and organizational development and all that other stuff. So I don't even worry about that. I focus on the 75% of people. What I rarely meet is somebody who goes, I'm okay being racist. Like no one says that, right? They don't say that. What they say is, I don't know what this has to do with me teaching or working or my life or my blah, 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 because I am okay, right? I grew up poor. I played basketball and all I have are, you know, friends of color. I wasn't rich. And so I was always around other folks of color where we grew up and blah, 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 blah. And so they have yet to understand their own privilege. And so I always say to those folks, I get it. You had numerous compounding disadvantages. Race just wasn't one of them.
And still is not one of them.
So while you may have grown up with some things, you know, your privilege helped you overcome some of those situations. And as a result, you still have privilege, even though you may have some things in common with folks of color. And so people just have to get there. Like they just have to. They have to get there. It's a journey.
It is such a journey. I will tell you that you're getting through to me in ways that I've been wanting to get through, be impacted for the longest time, because I kept hearing the words, but somehow or another, either the walls were just almost ready to crumble or something. But like this weekend when I was in Freedom, Georgia, somebody that I love and like and really respect, a Black woman. She's really a toughie. And I don't know if she was tired or I don't know what, because I know she cares about me too, but she just got on me. I mean, and it was just like, I was like, I'm sorry, and I started getting defensive, and it was just not, but I'm not, you know, I feel her, but I didn't know what. And then I talked to another friend, and he explained to me, you know, we're all in this, and it's intense, and blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, I was still defending myself a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's natural. I think we have to give ourselves some grace. I would say, and I appreciate your feedback that what I'm saying is landing differently. But I would also say, you've been doing this work for a minute and maybe you're ready to hear it. So for me, it's like church. I've been in church my whole life. And I'm like, and then the minister pulls out a scripture and I'm like, I've been reading this scripture for the past 25 years, but today it lands differently, right? I'm at a place in my maturity. I'm at a place in my walk where, I know I've read this scripture, but 87 times. Right. But oh my God, like what the way he said it,
right.
I'm ready to receive it differently.
Yeah.
Which goes back to, you know what I'm about to say, Nini, everything's a relationship. So it's just like when you're in a relationship with a significant and you've said, listen, I need you to take this trash out for whatever reason. And then 3 years later, they're like, you know what? I think I should take the trash out. You're like, for real? So now you're taking the trash out. Well, I hear you because now, notice I'm doing a do right now. I kind of feel like I've been listening and I've heard it. And I was at the, I was at the barbershop and the dude was like, you should probably take the trash out for your wife. And I was thinking now I should, right. So what we get it when we get it, right. It's a journey on that. But listen, that might just be my experience with the trash out, but I'm just saying.
No. Thank you. And so it's just an ongoing. And of course, I mean, life, that's life,
Absolutely. You know. What I will say is, I wrote the latest book with my writing partner, Chris Knaus, who is a white male. And people always ask me, so you're writing books with white men? What does that mean, right? Who is not a Christian, who you're talking about across difference, right? Race, gender, beliefs. But when we met, he had done some work already on himself, on his privilege. He moved differently. And what he did not say to me is, I'm going to be an ally. He never said that. Thank God. What he said was, you know what? I'm about this work and, let's do some work together. And that was it. And we began to get a relationship based upon how he moved and we started to build trust, right? And so that's what happened. And we could have some courageous conversations. So when I went to visit the Smithsonian African-American Museum in DC, we were in DC for a conference and he and I took MARTA or whatever it is. And we go, and I was like, you're gonna go? He was like, yeah, I wanna go. I was like, great, great, great.
What's MARTA?
I think that's their BART.
Okay.
So what I'm saying, I'm painting this picture of this journey on the way here.
Okay.
We're just hanging out and it's a good time. We're about to go to this museum. Have you been, Nini?
Probably 30 years ago.
Okay. So this is the museum to end all museums for the history of African Americans in this country. So anyway, so we go and about 30 minutes in, I'm like, listen, I can't talk to you today. And he was like, but we just got here. Like what happened? I was like, I can't, what I'm experiencing right now, I need to experience.
Yeah.
And you can't be in this for me, and I've known this man for years, right? And and so I totally get what you experienced because he was like, what is happening? We came there together. But I was like, you're gonna have to go somewhere. I'll meet you back at the hotel. I can't even travel with you back to the hotel. I need space. And so, it was super triggering and there was a lot going on for me in that moment. Yeah. And then I had to come back to him and be like, listen, I know I kind of came for you, but I needed you to not be there as a white person because there was so much pain in those levels of floors that I was experiencing. I couldn't do that with you. And so I'm not sure what your friend was experiencing, but given where you guys were and the travel that you were taking, there, you know, it's difficult and it's hard. And that trauma is triggering. And she may have taken that out on you in a way that just said, I just need not to be around white folks right now. And that's why the beauty of affinity is so important, that we create spaces of affinity so that people can have that place to like figure that stuff out. So yeah, it reminded me of how I went off on Chris when you brought that up with your friend.
Well, as you know, last weekend I was at the Legacy Museum. Have you been to that?
I have not.
And then to the monument with all the, that EJI put up. I keep forgetting the name. Do you know what I'm talking about? The Memorial for Peace and Justice.
Yes.
I mean, that's traumatizing.
And
I was astounded how many Black people were there. There were more Black people than white people, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I went there with four other people and I couldn't be with anybody. I really see what you're, I, yeah, no words, no words.
Right,
yeah. Okay. So, yeah, at a certain point, it seems like what we've come to in this conversation is that experience and understanding, they cannot exist separately. And maybe that courage piece is the opening up to the experience. And how do people come to that? Because I know some white people that don't feel they can.
Yeah. And for those who don't, they probably won't. So,
and they're good people.
Well, there's a good, bad binary, right? What does that mean?
Right.
Like I'm a good person. I just don't feel like talking about race because I don't think it has anything to do with me. I would argue, is that a good human? Right. Like, so like we, you know, it's just, you know, what is good and all those pieces.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's get to our youth. That's my hope for the future.
Okay.
Let's get to them so that they can make some changes. What I would say to folks who are grappling with like, but I really feel like I want to work on this.
Right.
The most important thing is to learn the true history.
Yes.
Not the history that we all learned in school.
Yes.
Right. The history in school was, there was this thing called slavery. We got rid of it. And now Obama's president. Like that's the.
And now it's all good. Yeah.
It's all good.
Like we're doing way better all the time, all the way.
Okay. Look at what's been happening. So let's really delve into the history. Part of the training that I offer is a historical perspective of what has happened in race, what has happened with race in America. When was this notion of whiteness started? Because folks were British, you know, and so when did it become white? What does it mean to be white in this country? And how does that show up even now, right? Those are really important pieces to learn. The dehumanization of Black people, which is why there's anti-Blackness and as a concrete form of racism. And what does that mean and how does that still, right? How is that still prevalent today? Like let's learn more. If there's books you need to read, you know, like whatever those pieces are, let's immerse ourselves in that learning. The other thing that I say is that, you know, interrogate the ways in which you utilize your whiteness as property, right? In what ways is whiteness a privilege that you pass down to your children by having, do you have conversations with your children around what does it mean to be white in this country? Do you tell them that not only are they not better than anyone, but people will see them as better? See, that's right. That's the thing. A lot of parents are like, oh, I tell my son all the time, he is not better than anybody else. I was like, right. But the world sees him, this country sees him as better. as a white person. So what does that mean for him to, are you raising co-conspirators? Are you raising advocates? Are you raising the group of people that's like, I'm a good person, I'm not racist, right? Like, who are you raising? So that's the second thing. And then the notion of dismantling white supremacy is not for people of the global majority, right? Racism was started by white folks and it is your burden to erase it. And so the reason we must have co-conspirators is because ultimately white folks own this piece of, of this work. And I was doing a training with a group and they were like, well, don't you think that several people of color have done what they could? And I was like, if we could have gotten rid of white supremacy by now, do you not think that somewhere between slavery and 2021, we would have been able to do that? That is not our, it's not our power, right? No. It is the power of white folks. So those three things, like learn your history, right? What are you teaching the children, the generations behind you? And, you know, gather with your people in affinity and let's dismantle.
On another note, I was traveling this weekend, so I just sort of skimmed my email, but I saw something in the anti-racism daily email. You know, do you know about that?
No.
It's pretty good sometimes. And this one, the subject line was something about get rid of your spiritual bypass. And I just skimmed the article, but it was just like, oh, that's okay, because I'm you know, I'm transcending that, you know, and I'm just all love and
I'm a good person.
Yeah. So it's just kind of a
various,
a different wrinkle.
So my question becomes, are you actively being anti-racist and how do you know?
So, and it's fascinating. It starts to sound maybe not that interesting until you get into it and you realize the layers and layers of self-awareness that come alive and how much more alive and awake is aliveness and wakeness is possible by engaging in this kind of activity.
Or just, you know, what you know, for me, obviously I'm trying to create a better world for my for grandchildren, but for white folks, like what's the do different? Like what's one or two things that you're going to do differently as you start to engage in this? I've given three examples, but you know, what's that internal monologue that you have with yourself the next time you as a white woman are in an elevator with a black man and the elevator door is closed, right? What's the internal dialogue that you have there? What's the internal dialogue that you have, you know, when you're at Napa French Laundry and then you see a couple of young black men coming in to have dinner? Like what's that dialogue that happens? Like just like checking self. What's the dialogue that happens the next time a white female feels the necessity to have to say something to a person of color? What's the internal dialogue? Do you really have to?
I love these examples. I wish you would just keep talking and talking because those are the little time points when they pop up to you consciously or they just pass by unconsciously and you keep in your same patterns.
Correct.
And that's why I want to keep on having conversations like this on this podcast where people can listen and become aware and not be, you know, on the defensive and just can listen passively and just really start to self-examine. So
I think that's so valid. Yesterday at the car wash, I'm minding my own business in line. You know, I'm going through the, you know, through where you take your car through the car wash, right? Like it's not by hand, right?
Yeah.
So there's four cars ahead of me and I get up to the front and this lovely, bless her heart, lovely older white woman, you know, comes up, taps on my window. So first of all, I'm like, you're too close. It's COVID. Why are you tapping on my window? So I'm like, you know, I pull the window down just a little bit. I'm like, can I help you? I don't have a mask on. I'm in my car. Right. So now I'm all right. So she was like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just wondering, shouldn't you be moving up? Right. Cause I don't know how to get my car washed. Right. So like, I was like, what? She was like, you know, there's nobody ahead of you. Right. Because what happens in the car wash is the person ahead of you goes into the little car wash thing. Yeah. Right. And they're doing their car wash while you're waiting at the front. And I said, there's someone in the car wash, ma'am. She was like, what? And I was like, yeah, there's someone in there. She was like, oh, I just thought maybe there was something wrong with it that you hadn't moved forward. So in this particular instance, number one, this has nothing to do with you.
Right.
Lovely, lovely, helpfully old white woman. This has nothing to do with you. If I sit there for 30 minutes, right, it has nothing. Why do you feel like you need to come get out of your car to come to my car to tell me, to ask me to move up, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is I already know what I'm doing. Okay. And so obviously I'm waiting to get my car washed. If I did not go into the car wash, assume that there's a reason, right? And so it is in this particular case, this wasn't even necessarily around race. It's just around the privilege of feeling like she needed to have this conversation. And really, I wanted her to say, do I really need to get on my car and have this conversation with this wonderful person?
Yeah.
I could have been any race, right? Did she need to do that? Her privilege makes her feel like, I'm going to go talk to this person and figure out why they haven't moved forward. And right. And it's just like, what? Why would you feel like that's your role?
Yeah. I wonder if I've ever been that little old helpful white woman. Probably.
Absolutely.
Probably.
Absolutely. It's just a thing that wonderful white women have about feeling like they need to, like it's burning within them. They need to be super helpful.
Wow.
And we read that as privilege.
And you read that as privilege. Thank you, because sometimes I get looks that I don't understand when I'm just expecting thank you. So thank you. I never want to talk to you again, Michelle.
It's like, right, because I'm sure she was like, oh, I'm supposed to say, oh, thank you for being helpful. I didn't notice that I'm supposed to move. Right. Listen, sometimes I want to be like, just sit in the car, baby. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
But it's the privilege, because folks of color rarely, if ever, feel like they can do that, especially if it had been reversed. So if I had been a Black woman, this was a white woman in the car, number one, I'm not knocking on your car window, right, at all. Like,
yeah,
I have to barely see you're not breathing before I'm going to knock on the car window.
Right.
Like, so it's just, it's a different way of being.
Yeah. I mean, after this weekend, I just felt that there were just, of course I knew it, but it was just so wonderful to see all the ways that the cultural differences that are just so, you know, that I need to, I'm incredibly comfortable around them and I love them, but mm-hmm. I have to realize their differences and I have to, yeah. And so one thing that this woman was telling me, she was just absolutely adamant that I read Robin DiAngelo's book.
Yeah.
And do you think concur?
I like Robin DiAngelo. Many, 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 many folks are like, I feel like she's writing from privilege. She is. I feel like she's writing to white people. She is. I mean, I think she was very purposeful in this book saying, I'm going to write this book for white folks like me, you know, where she was in her journey, who may not understand a lot of their own ways that privilege affects them. Mm-hmm. As a person who does race work, it was great for me to read, because so much of what I read is written by folks of color, which I have that perspective.
Right.
I was able to get a different perspective. And really, this goes back to the beginning, Nini. At my heart, I'm an educator. I'm a social emotional learning expert and believe in the embedding of social emotional practices within education. So in my heart, I'm always looking for the way that I can understand, right?
Yes.
So I'm angry, I'm pissed a lot of times, I'm right. But in my heart, I'm thinking, if this person, you know, like the person at the car wash, was she really being intentionally like this horrible person? No, she probably thought she was being helpful. And as you said, wanted to thank you. Right. But I need her to then be able to go, didn't get the response I was looking for.
Right.
What might that have said about me?
Right.
Robin DiAngelo's book, I think, provides some ways for folks to get that. Now, I've definitely had other folks of color be like, that's not the book for me. And then, you know, and it's not, right? But for white folks, I'm always like, let's read that first, but then let's read, you know, so the one that you have, so you want to talk about race, let's read that. And then let's read, like, let's get into a variety of different books.
Okay. Because I am annoyed with Robin DiAngelo, and yes. I've watched some of her YouTubes, definitely don't care for her voice. But why are you laughing? Oh my God, what did I do?
No, it was funny because I listen to people's voices, right? You know, because I sing, so I'm always listening to people, and I heard that. That's okay. Funny. Okay. Yeah, but I was like, well, you know, maybe that's Pacific Northwest. I mean, I don't know.
Okay. So, but if you tell me to read it, then I will read it, even though.
I think it's another piece of data.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. I just get to have you for like 4 or 5 more minutes. What else? Anything else you want to bring up?
I think I sent you our flyer. We're doing a training, my writing partner and I, in August 9th, 10th, and 13th. It's called Wokeness, Don't Stop Bullets, Deliberately Provocative. But it's really about ways in which we can, those of us who are trying to do this work, can sustain. This would be for people who feel like they're already in the work and we're trying to figure out how to sustain ourselves in the work. The one thing that lots of data is showing is that folks can't do this for a very long time.
Yeah.
This meaning anti-racist work, it's just too hard.
It's
soul sucking. And, you know, I'm on the other side of the work right now on my way to vacation. So yes. Like what you're getting is the really happy Rochelle, but had we spoken in February, I was just bogged down, you know, like the heaviness was pressing on me. So that's happening August 9th, 10th, and 13th. And let me know if you need me to send you another flyer in case you want to put that wherever when you do the podcast.
I absolutely will. I have it, but if you want to send it to me again, because, you know, I've been out of the loop for, you know, 5 days, but I can find it. So you don't have to.
And then the only other thing
Who would come to that? Who would come to that?
Folks who are folks, both white and folks of color, who are doing the work and want to talk about self-sustaining strategies, right? So what we're not going to do is spend a lot of time going, this is what racism is, right? We're assuming the folks who come to that are already doing some of their own work, but they want to try and figure out, how do we sustain in this? This is pretty hard. We have some strategies that we want to offer, you know, so we can keep the work going, because it's super, super difficult.
Okay.
So that's the flyer. And then just, you know, my work is at my website, RochelleRogersArt.com, and I am available to continue doing my favorite work is with women. And so nothing against the men, but I just like working with women who are trying to figure this out, right? And both in spaces of affinity with women of color, but also in mixed groups, because I think there's a power in women saying, this is what's happened. There's a lot of history between white women and Black women that we never talk about. There's just a lot there. So that's my joy area. So I'm available for folks who want to engage in those types of conversations. That's an area that we've just not tapped into.
And when you say groups of affinity, what are you thinking specifically? I know what that means to me, but what does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I do work with people of the global majority in affinity with just folks of color, or I do work with folks of color mixed with white folks together. So I do both.
Okay, so that's the level of affinity. You're not talking about like people that are in a certain interest group or?
No, racial affinity, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Good. I don't like letting you go. I'm almost glad we recorded another
time. Do it again. There's good. No problem. I'm not going anywhere.
Except you're going on vacation, and I bless you. So you deserve that one.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you. Yeah, this is, again, my thing with women, right? Like, so rare, particularly for African-American women, but so rare that women say, I'm going to intentionally take care of myself, right? Even when we take vacation, it's like, I'm going to be on vacation, but I'm going to check email. Or I'm going to be on vacation, but if you need me, no, that's not what we do. And we so rarely put ourselves ahead of others that even if we're on vacation, right, we're dragging the children and we're, you know, doing all this other stuff and we're bringing the neighborhood children and, you know, no, none of that. So yeah, on vacation for a month for me, right, to do what I want to do, probably going to sit by a rock somewhere and go buy some water and
have a non-conversation
and not talk.
Good.
But available after August.
Fabulous. Good. Maybe we'll get to meet in person one of these days.
Yeah, I'm fully vaccinated. So I'm
good.
I'm
Me too. Well, I love you and I so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Nini. Thank you for reaching out. Like, I can't imagine the courage that took out of the blue to be like, hey, girl, you want to come on my podcast? Right. So I can imagine that could be intimidating. Thank you for reaching out. Thank you for providing this space. And thank you for engaging in courage and having the courage to engage in real conversation. I appreciate it.
See, that's the one thing that this courage thing, I mean, I don't know how to not do this. It would be.
But you've got some courage going on.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. It's just, I have to talk to you. I mean, if all you could do is say no, but the opportunity to talk to a woman with your insight and intelligence and heart, what's the worst you could say to me is no. And the best you could say is this. And I'm just so grateful to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it so much. We'll talk again soon.
Yes. Yes, we will.
Feel free to reach out at any time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Nini.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Rochelle wanted everyone to know about her upcoming remote leadership engagement series titled Wokeness Don't Stop Bullets, Authentic Leadership to Challenge Intersectional Racism. Rochelle writes that the purpose of this 3-day remote leadership engagement series is to shake systems and to soothe souls. Dates are August 9th, 10th, and 13th. Of the year 2021 from 9 a.m. until noon each day. For more information, contact authenticleadership21@gmail.com. Also, everyone would benefit from Rochelle's recently published book, Black Educational Leadership, From Silencing to Authenticity, which Rochelle co-authored with Christopher Naus, PhD. The book explores a topic few of us white people are even aware needs attention, but which focuses on Black educational leadership and the development of anti-racist, purpose-driven leadership identities. The book's dedication reads, "To the many, many children who grow up without being able to learn from powerful, authentic Black school leaders, and to the many, many Black educators who feel they cannot be who they are and keep their jobs." The Amazon link is in this show's notes. That dedication clearly speaks to an unacceptable deficiency in our educational systems that we whites must acknowledge, absorb, and be intentional about helping to correct. The book is designed for district administrators as well as faculty and students in race and ethnicity in education, urban education, and educational leadership. You can learn more about Rochelle on her website with the link in this show's notes as well. Thank you again for your time, your energy, and your intentional engagement with the multi-layered topics that are the realities of anti-racism education for us so-called white people. Ashe.